problem was how to translate for Americans the speech of American characters, African-American characters, written by a Mexican guy who'd never been to North America. So, and had very intense fantasies of what African-American life might be like in Detroit, in Harlem. None of them corresponding to any reality that I know about. So it was, that was a lot of fun and very hard.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulubi. Roberto Bolaño's novel, 2666, takes place over the course of 8 decades and spans several continents. It's set mostly in the sprawling industrial city of Juarez in northern Mexico. Its characters range from that African-American journalist to German academics. It's at once book and literary event. Roberto Bolaño died 5 years ago, at the age of 50. He'd contracted a rare liver disease. The Chilean-born author has long been a world literature star, but we in the United States are just getting acquainted with his works. Time magazine called 2666 a police procedural straight from the precinct of hell. It is also, quote, as devastating a reading experience as you are likely ever to encounter. This discussion of Roberto Bolaño's 2666 is led by Lauren Stein, senior editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It was recorded in January 2009 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Hi. The truth is that I and everybody else at the company I work for has been very puzzled by the reaction to 2666. It sold many more copies than we thought it would, and we don't really understand why. And we've been very surprised that people like the book, because I found it very depressing and hard-going, especially compared to The Savage Detectives and Bolaño's other books, which I found to be a lot of fun. And 2666, as I go back every once in a while and look at it again now, I find that I love it. In fact, it's aging better than the other ones on me. But when it was my job to think about it, I found it a chore. So a couple of critics have written well about the question of why everyone seems to like Bolaño. And a friend of mine wrote something that I showed to my friend Jennifer, who's here, about this question, saying, of all writers, why Bolaño? And he says, in Spanish, we have a certain explanation. His Spanish is very plain, and Spanish literature tends to be frilly, exactly, and he's very unfrilly, like Borges. But that doesn't explain, because we've got lots of plain writers. So in the end, he didn't come up with a very good explanation. So let's talk a little bit about what 2666 is about. Can someone say in a sentence what the first book, what happens in the first book, someone who's read it more recently than I have?
4 academics are in search of their favorite writer, who they are specialists in that field.
Right.
And they go to Mexico to find him. 3 go to Mexico.
3.
And they all have interesting relationships with each other.
Yeah.
It's very Eurocentric. And then all of a sudden, there you are in northern Mexico.
And then they disappear, and then that's the last we hear of them, which is the pattern of the book. But remember, in book 2, we see it through the eyes of one guy, of Amalfitano.
Book 2, there is this Chilean literature professor who ends up with his daughter in this northern Mexican town. And at least when I read it, it seemed that he was losing his mind or worrying about his daughter against the background of the violence to women and losing his mind.
Yeah. And the two things seem very much related to each other, right? And then book 3.
Book 3 is about a journalist who writes for a small African-American newspaper in Harlem, who winds up going to northern Mexico to cover a boxing match, but becomes interested in the journalistic sort of importance of covering the murder of these women in Sonora. And he eventually winds up meeting the daughter. Am I giving away too much?
I was just wondering whether you would.
I take it all back. None of that happens. There's just a guy. He winds up in Mexico. Okay, I apologize.
It's so great.
I'll leave it at that.
I spend so much of my work life doing what we're doing now, and you're doing it so much better than I ever do. It's too bad I have to do it before the book comes out. Then in book 4, No one's gotten to book four.
Well, that was a hard one to read, and I had to read it very quickly because there were many murders, and each described in a very difficult way. Many characters came and went, and I lost some along the way, and that was frustrating. But it really was quite horrific, I have to say.
The New Yorker is they're reading 2666 this month, and everyone's bogging down in book four because no one can stand it. It's really awful. It gives you nightmares. It really does. And then book five goes back to World War II. We see the early life of that first, the writer who the four academics are interested in. We see him growing up and becoming a writer himself. And then there's the ending, and I won't give that away. Now, why did I sketch all that out? I don't know. Well, the question, I guess I wanted everyone to have some idea of the book we're talking about, and you have some idea of the difficulties it presents when you're trying to talk about it in a way that a publisher would want to talk about a book. I mean, that's not a conventional plot, and characters disappear and don't come back. Bolaño is really good at killing characters. I don't just mean the murdered women, but he can get rid of people at a moment when you wouldn't think a novelist could. So it raises the question what it is about his style. Can someone who's read any of his books say something about what you think is most characteristic of his style, if you had to describe it to someone who'd never read him?
For me, it's the way he leapfrogs from one thing to another. That it's just dazzling.
Can someone else give an example of that?
In the chapter on the murders, it's not just the murders. He'll intersperse them with other things that are going on.
Like?
None comes to mind right now. But not only that, but his style is similar. He'll be writing in plain sentences, very short sentences, and then all of a sudden there's a sentence that's
wacko.
A page long.
Yeah.
And it's just a very interesting.
Yeah, just another aspect of his style. In his two short books, which I've read, and I'm now reading the Savage Detectives, which is very different, but the two short books, I'd say poetic subliminal.
The stuff people aren't talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And can't probably even describe, aren't aware of in themselves. He's revelatory in a very effective way.
I wouldn't have thought to put it that way. I think I know what you mean. Especially in 2666, but in all of his books. You know, Bolaño only started writing fiction in the last 10 years of his life after he'd already been told by the doctors that he would die within a few years. He had a liver disease, and it had flared up and left his liver very compromised. And then they knew that the virus would come back, and that when it did, it would kill him because his liver was so weakened. So he started writing fiction to support his wife and kids, knowing that whatever reputation he would have would be posthumous. And especially in 2666, one of the things that goes without being said, but I think you're talking about By Night in Chile, I bet, and Distant Star, where books that are taking place in an atmosphere where people are, there's one scene in By Night in Chile when people are at a cocktail party and someone gets lost and goes into a basement of the house where the party is and finds someone on a rack. Someone's being tortured on a rack. And it sounds corny when I say it, but it's scary. And in fact, it happens to have been true. He was describing something that had happened. But in 2666, where we see this literature, I think he's a philosophy professor, becoming unhinged with his anxiety for his daughter, you also feel the anxiety of someone who is worrying about his own removal from his own family. He knows he's about to die, and sometimes he gets angry about it, and sometimes he's scared, and often he's anxious for the people he's leaving behind. And there's that, and all those feelings seem to get wrapped up together. And I think there are a lot of the restraint and a lot of what doesn't get said in 2666, to me, seems like panic, real fear, that is kept always at bay and comes up in all these scary. Is part of, I think, what comes up in the murders. In fact, he died before he finished revising it, and so...
Just when I think of his style, I think of stories inside of stories. And 2666, I think, is really the sort of maturation of that thread and throughout the style of his writing. And I think sort of his style is captured, I think, in microcosm in a short story he wrote called Anne Moore's Life, which is one of the great short stories like I've read in years and years and years. And if anyone's interested in reading 2666 and wanted sort of an introduction to his style in microcosm, I can't recommend that story enough to everyone. But
tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, it starts out, it's a story called Anne Moore's Life, and it's in a collection of his called Last Evenings on Earth, which is just a magnificent short story collection. And it's basically a story written about this woman, Anne Moore's life. And what's amazing about it is the economy and the compression that he's able to encompass inside a really narrow number of pages. And it really feels like when you're finished with it, you feel like you've almost read a novel, because there's so much in it. But it's really looped together as sort of one story about her life inside another story inside of another, and it keeps moving forward. And ultimately, when you sort of get to the end, it expands in a really interesting way. There's clues, but it ends in this. I don't want to give it away. Like I almost did the other part of it, but
I know I keep asking you questions that are very dangerous.
Exactly,
you better get off the thin
but it's a great introduction, I think, to his writing style in general, and I kind of think 2666 was an extension, a little bit, of some of the things he was doing in that short story. So it's an interesting read before the novel, or even after.
This stories within stories, and the sense of things that are the pressures on the stories that don't get expressed explicitly, and the matter of leaps. All I think those are capture things that are great about Bolaño. But honestly, really, to talk about his style, I think you need to say what critics can't say, really, which is that there's a lot of stuff that's missing from his books that we expect from fiction. And I think that's what my friend's essay in N Plus One really gets at. But I think it's also part of what makes him so attractive as a writer, is that the characters often are described as if sometimes they're real. Often in The Savage Detectives, for example, everyone in that book, I mean, everyone in Mexico claims to be a character in The Savage Detectives. And 50 of them are right, 50 of them are telling you the truth. And they're described the way you or I would describe a friend to someone else who knew him or her, possibly. They're not rounded characters, they're often gestured at. And even when he's talking about completely make-believe people, he tends to just sort of to give you much less than you expect a novelist to give you. And somehow that feels very realistic, because it's hard to put your finger on, but it makes him very persuasive and unsatisfying at the same time, in a way that I really like. And I'm surprised that everybody else likes too, or so many people.
He has this amazing ability to start writing almost about anything in smallest fragments or in several pages, and you're completely drawn into it, however little he'll give you.
Yeah.
And you become comfortable with something because he liked these literary scholars. He obviously is making fun of the whole enterprise, and you sort of get comfortable with the style. And then he's going to shift and make you completely uncomfortable with the guy who's losing his mind. Yeah. But smallest fragments will draw you in, and you'll just ask for more, and then he switches to something completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hypnotic. I mean, I don't know.
I couldn't agree more. It's never boring, which is strange.
It just changes so sporadically, so you're thrown off guard, but you have to keep going, otherwise you'll never finish the book, but you keep wanting to finish the book anyway.
Yeah.
So,
So that's how I felt.
Okay.
Except I had to do it for my job.
Well, that's a little bit tougher.
But I thought I would feel that way even if I didn't have to do it for my job. And it's very surprising. This is very hard to talk about, too, and it's something else that critics, I think, it's something that we can say informally in a place like this, but it's very hard to put in a way that makes you sound smart or even coherent in print. But it always feels as though it's coming from somewhere real, either that it's being drawn from the life or that it's coming out of strong feeling in a man who is, who kind of wears his weaknesses on his sleeve. He's very vain. In The Savage Detectives, he, by the end of The Savage Detectives, we're watching him go off and be a foreign correspondent in Africa and be very macho. And there's something about the openness of his vanity that makes you, you think, well, yeah, you know, here you are dying, writing great books. Let yourself get the girl sometimes, you know. And he does. And in the same way, that same weakness lets him talk about himself, but also about everybody else he loves and hates, with that intensity of emotion of imminent loss. And that sounds fancy, but I think if you read a couple of pages, you see right away, it's the same way he writes about Mexico, where he hadn't been back to Mexico in 15 years when he wrote 2666. He was in email contact all the time with his friends, asking them whether things were still there. He became very close to a reporter who was writing a book about the murders, who is a character, naturally is a character in 2666, actually under his own name. I heard an interesting thing from another writer saying that there's a moment when the reporter has this epiphany. He's in a whorehouse, and he's just slept with a prostitute, and he's telling her about these crimes, that these, as he tells her, you know, these women are getting killed in Sonora, and she's bored. She falls asleep, or she yawns, and he says, "Don't you have any feelings of professional solidarity with?" And she looks at him and says, "They're not whores. They're workers. They're factory workers." That's when the reporter, the story changes for the reporter, and the story changes in the book, because these women are so vulnerable, not just because they're sex workers. They're not sex workers. They're vulnerable because they're working in these huge factories, and no one's protecting them when they go to work, when they come home from work. There's no life choice that they could make that would make them safe. And that happened in that whorehouse to that reporter. I mean, Bolaño just didn't make any of it up. So he, even when it comes to places, there's a sense of memorializing the way Pelicanos writes about Washington. You know, there's a kind of 14th and U looks like this, and a feeling of, because it might not next week, you know. Anyway.
I'm from El Paso, Texas. I was born and raised there, so my family's still there, and I was there at the time when the murders began. And I think this book is really shocking as I'm going through it, because right now the situation in Ciudad Juarez, which is really Santa Teresa in the book.
Can you explain that?
Ciudad Juarez is the city that borders El Paso, and that's the Twin City, and that is where these murders are taking place, have taken place. In the last 15, 16 years, about over 300 women have been murdered there. And if you keep up with the news right now, Ciudad Juarez is now considered to be even more dangerous than Iraq, than Baghdad, than anywhere in Iraq. The murder rate is, it's horrific, the drug wars there. So in reading this, being a native of there, I live here now, but having spent a lot of time, of course, growing up there in El Paso, it's so prophetic, I think, in so many ways. And if you know his background, one of my favorite poets, I was very surprised, but then I wasn't. Going back to the question of his style, Nicanor Parra, I don't know if anybody's familiar with his work, but I would strongly suggest he's a Chilean poet. He's really very much up there with Pablo Neruda. And
Bolaño,
so,
would say way above.
Yeah, way above. So if you go back and you read his poetry, and I really encourage everybody to read his poetry, you will see his style almost mimicking Parra's style. And Parra's still alive. I had the opportunity, I bumped into him when I was in Chile. We were in a restaurant.
Wow.
And his family, they're a group of artists, and his sister, Violeta Parra, was a very famous folk singer in Latin America, and Joan Baez and many other American female singers have covered her work. But anyway, if you go back and you read his poetry, you will see how Bolaño really adapted that. But just reading the paper, I mean, every time I pick up the Washington Post, you will see Ciudad Juarez in the post and the situation, the what's happening in Mexico. So I find this book, as I'm reading it and I'm going into that chapter, that horrific chapter, and knowing people who worked on this case and who have set up protests against the Mexican government for the inaction, I'm just curious, does anybody know why he chose to base this on those murders?
He talked a lot about it, saying different things to different friends at different times about it. He said for years that he was working on a book that was, it was going to be a science fiction book. And then the murders, at a certain point, the murders took over and sort of ran away with the book. It happened after he'd started writing it that they became what the book was about. It's interesting partly because it's so close to exploitative. I mean, you know, to write hundreds of pages where you're just one, basically, coroner's report after another. No one said it in a review, but it made me very uncomfortable, I think. And yet it's persuasive in some way. And I think it's because you feel that it's, oh, I don't know. Maybe not everyone feels that way, but did anyone end up feeling uncomfortable about the...
I haven't read that, but the Godard's movie, The Weeknd, that has the horrendous accident pile up, was very deliberately exploitive of the viewer in exposing and overexposing the viewer to carnage and playing with that. I have no idea whether that was part of it. But the murders also figure in, is it By Night in Chile that has the murder of women too? Or mm-hmm. I think in a smaller frame.
Yeah, people disappear. I mean...
The women, there were women being mm-hmm.
in Distant
dismembered.
Star.
Oh, Distant Star, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I haven't heard that there was a question about how the book was supposed to end. The version I heard is that it was pretty clear in the discs what was what. The question was whether he had more work to do, whether he would have given it one more revision. The book is very open-ended, but as his executor pointed out, it would have been a fair guess that the book before that had been left unfinished, because there's no way of knowing. So that's the version that I've heard, and I believe it. I don't read Spanish. I just started taking Spanish lessons too late for it to be any good to me for 2666. But I've worked for many books with the same translator, and we've kind of grown up together in this work. So she explains to me what the questions are, what the problems are. And by now, there's almost no editing to do, because we've had the same fight so many times through so many books that we've kind of fought to a draw. It's a lot of fun. Except for the Oscar fate sections, where we discussed it and discussed it. The problem was how to translate for Americans the speech of American characters, African-American characters, written by a Mexican guy who'd never been to North America. So, you know, that was very peculiar, and had very intense fantasies of what African-American life might be like in Detroit, in Harlem. None of them corresponding to any reality that I know about. So that was a lot of fun and very hard. And Natasha, that was the part that was fun to watch. I sent Natasha away and she came back with something that was 100% better. And now that's my favorite part to read, because it's so much fun to watch the translator solving unsolvable looking problems with every sentence. A Spanish friend of mine was in New York when Bolaño died. They were very close, and she'd told me about her friend who was sick, and then he died. And I was visiting her later in Spain, and I'd never read him, and we were in a bookstore, and she found the New Directions, an English language copy of By Night in Chile, and said, "You schmuck, my dead friend, you still haven't read him. You have to read him." And I read it on the first leg of the flight back to New York from Barcelona to Madrid, and it's such a short book. I spent the rest of the flight awake on the airplane thinking, how could I have been such a moron not to have read this guy? This isn't just a good foreign writer. This guy's better than any of the Americans I've read in a long time. What are we doing wrong? How could I not have heard of this? And what does this mean for my job? You know, and I'm I'm glad you think I'm kidding. I went straight to the office from the airport and told my boss that I thought we must be making, not that we must be making a mistake, but that there were things out there that we just didn't know about. And by coincidence, a year later, I mean, I mentioned how much I loved the Bolaño's work to his Spanish editor, who is a character in 2666. He's Bubis, more or less. And by chance, the estate decided that in the countries where Bolaño wasn't very, very famous yet, they decided that they would give those two big books, he wrote two big fat books, that they would sell those off to a corporate house. I work for a house that's owned by a corporation. So that happened by chance, and we were very eager to buy them, and we did. I edited a lot of translations. I'm working on a translation now, and I've translated a book before myself, and its translation is something I love to think about, especially when it's not from a language I know, because then I feel no loyalty to the original text, and I can just kvetch. And especially on The Savage Detectives, there was a lot of fun work to be done, because it's a very colloquial book, and the translator, lots of fun questions come up about how to be faithful, especially when the original is very close to street language. Dialect and colloquialism don't age together in two different languages. So that the word that if I say the word guy, this guy said that, and we take a word in French that means guy today, in 10 years, the words will have done different things. They will have drifted apart. So the translator, if the translator is really working to make something lasting, will often have to restrain herself and deaden the language a little bit and make it heightened a little bit, make it a little more literary. And it meant doing something that's very hard for a translator to do, which is not show off. There are 50 narrators in The Savage Detectives from different countries speaking different kinds of Spanish. And Natasha decided that she wasn't going to try to capture that in the English. Incredible renunciation. I was so impressed by that. It was so classy. And I think the result was really good. And in 2666, that was less of a question. But those are the kinds of things that come up, even when you're... With The Savage Detectives, there was a French and an Italian translation. My boss reads Italian and translates from Italian. I read French and translate from French. And we would sometimes, when there was a difficult passage, and you could tell from the English that it was difficult, we would look at the French and the Italian and look at how those sounded. And even if you don't read Italian, you can tell when the Italian is funny. And the Italian, the beginning of the Italian edition was funny. And Natasha's wasn't funny at first. And I could point to it and say, look, is it as funny as that in the Spanish? And she said, yeah, it's as funny as that in the Spanish. And I said, well, do your job. So.
The question is, I was trying to imagine, and I don't know if any of it was sort of came to you, that it would be very difficult for a woman translator to translate, where you really have to get into the text and live with it, to translate the middle part of this book.
The part about the autopsies.
And the part of just like clinical reports of horrendous violence,
yeah,
to women, and specifically to women.
Not to mention the jokes in the police barracks.
The police jokes, I mean, I just finished reading it. It's sickening.
It's sickening.
And I, as a translator, how difficult was it for her to produce something which reads clinical, clean, in a way?
Luckily, I've heard her answer the question, so I feel like I wouldn't speak for her otherwise, but I've heard her. She said she just sort of turned off her brain and just did it. You know, she just... The autopsies presented a technical problem that's really interesting because, you know, whenever you're dealing with... whenever you're translating something that's that has a formula to it, again, it's... How do you make a police report sound like a police report? So she was busy trying to do that, and she had to study a lot for this book. Like the Oscar Fate section, there's a long part where a Bobby Seale type character gives a long, quite insane, inspirational speech that has to do with barbecue, And Natasha's the one who found out that Bobby Seale, in fact, did write a book about barbecue called Barbecuing with Bobby. But that didn't explain what it was doing in the novel. And Natasha had to go back and reread Moby Dick because I thought it was pretty clear that that Bolaño was putting this Bobby Seale speech in to be, you think I'm right? Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you think I'm right. That the Bobby Seale speech was standing in where that sermon at the beginning of Moby Dick is. And it was clear that he was thinking of that. And that was a way for her to think about what it was doing in the book. She also had to read about boxing so she could learn how to talk about boxing. She had to learn prison books and blaxploitation novels. And for the police stuff, she had to do a lot of research. And the problem with the jokes was even worse because she had to make them up from scratch, these really misogynist jokes. And, you know, making up jokes is hard. Some of them we just cut. There were a couple of jokes that there was no way to make the joke make sense. And that's the only time in all the six books that I've edited of Natasha's, of her translations, that I've ever seen her, is it true? One of the only times that I've ever seen her cut something because it was impossible to translate.
Do you know how the book has been received in Mexico, or have you had any contact with anyone there?
It was a huge deal in Spain and I think all over Latin America. And, you know, one way I can gauge it is you see all the kids whose books come into us, and I look at the reader's reports and I discuss them with our Spanish readers. They're all writing Bolaño novels. And I don't know about me in Mexico in particular. I think he's kind of a hero there. I mean, the Mexicans I know all love him, but what does that mean?
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.